another episode of Lid Radio Podcast. I'm Francesca and I'll be your host. So for this episode, we have a special guest with us, Natasha Wallace. Now, Natasha is author of The Conscious Effect, 50 Lessons for Better Organisational Wellbeing, and she's the founder and chief coach of Conscious Works, a leadership and personal development business specialising in performance and wellbeing. As a former HR director, Natasha left paid employment having reached burnout. It led her to recognise that people need to start working differently if they are to thrive. It means paying greater attention to our needs and the needs of others. The way we do this is to become more conscious and more aware of ourselves and the people we lead. She set up her company to help leaders create healthier workplaces where people could do a great job while taking care of their long-term health and well-being. The Conscious Effect provides a new leadership approach for the modern workplace of work. So let's talk about you. You were an HR director and left paid employment due to burnout. What was the experience like having made the bold and brave decision to quit your job and focus on yourself? How did this influence the Conscious Effect?
So it was a really hard decision to leave my job. I'd done that particular job for 10 years and I loved it. And it was really only in the last few months of the job that I even considered that that was the sort of right time to leave.
Sure.
But actually, it's sort of almost sometimes things happen to you and your hand is forced. And I actually, you know, so on reflection, I can see I had absolutely no balance at all in my life. My purpose and what I did in my job had been so closely aligned. And I was lucky in that respect, because I think often people's purpose, if they know what their purpose is, isn't something that can be fulfilled through work. But, you know, my job did allow me to fulfill my purpose to some extent, which was to help people. And I think when you are so purposeful, it can mean that you do lose balance and you can lose sight of what's important. So I was working long hours. I wasn't spending enough time with my family, let alone my friends. Everything was about work. Everything was about creating the best place to work. It was my single focus. And actually, it made me feel that I was bringing some value. I don't necessarily think that I was, you know, consciously aware of that on a day-to-day basis, but it was fulfilling just knowing I could go to work and help people.
It
was the combination of working too hard and just spending no time looking after my well-being outside of work, coupled with the fact that I sort of came to the realization towards the end that I wasn't actually fulfilling my purpose.
Right.
I wasn't helping enough people in the right way, and that what I wanted to do and the help that I wanted to give people just wasn't possible in the role that I was working in. So I guess my purpose had become misaligned the purpose of the organization that I was working in. So it was tough. It was hard to leave. And I went through a bit of a grieving process after I had, which took quite a while to get through. But, you know, I'm really, really glad I am where I am now. But it definitely wasn't easy. And I can see why lots of other people stay in a job that they may not be happy in, just because it seems easier to stay and not be totally fulfilled than to go through the challenge of how to leave and get to the next phase in your life.
Yeah, I think unfortunately a lot of people can relate to the long hours and feeling unfulfilled. So it's clearly the book has a purpose as in itself to sort of try and fix this problem that's so universal.
Yeah, well, I hope so.
So I'm talking more about the book. So The Conscious Effect. Your book is striving to cut through the intense workloads and unhappy workplaces, as we mentioned, to create healthy and happy teams, and especially leaders. So what are your thoughts on companies who do not have budget for wellbeing at work? Are there still actions that can be put into place? Or is this the fundamental problem, that wellbeing is seen as not enough of a priority to have a budget behind it?
Okay, so I'm sure there's a lot of HR directors and HR people out there that are ahead of the curve and have figured out that well-being is not about perks, incentives and all of those other sort of fripperies, which are necessary because they're just part of the basic employee value proposition these days. But actually, it's more fundamentally about culture. So when I was working as an HR director, I can remember having a couple of meetings with my team and also with our benefits provider, who provided us with a whole pile of wellbeing benefits. So everything from health insurance to discounted dental cover. We also had things like an employee assistance program, discounted gym membership, childcare vouchers, all of those things that people in larger businesses maybe have just become used to. They're part of the standard benefits offer.
Sure.
Maybe not so much in SMEs, but certainly in larger companies. And I can remember sitting down and having a meeting about this where we were talking to our account managers, and I was saying, I really, really want to create an environment where people feel well. Like, how are we going to do that? And of course, we were talking about it through the lens of benefits, and we were never, ever going to get the right answer looking at it in that way. So I now say that, you know, the basics, just the things that people expect to go to work and receive, are things like voluntary benefits, those healthcare benefits that I was mentioning, employee assistance programs where they have access to free counselling. That's just, you know, standard issue now. The thing that organisations aren't paying enough attention to is how to create a culture where people feel safe. So a psychologically safe culture, as Amy Edmondson talks a lot about. And in her book, The Fearless Organisation, she actually really, really clearly links how being in an environment where you can take interpersonal risk and speak up and be yourself has a clear link to performance, and there's a lot of evidence and research now to support that theory.
Sure, yeah.
So, you know, you can improve well-being without spending a penny, because it's really about how people behave in the organisation. And that starts with the leaders. So my experience of being a leader and working with leaders was that we were all so focused on delivery, keeping the client happy, keeping the wolf away from the door in the recession, because things got really tough during that time where we were trying to sort of do more and more with less. There was less money to go around, less fees to go around. So people ended up having to sort of work harder. And the leaders weren't immune to this. And I always thought this was quite interesting. A lot of the narrative that you hear in the marketplace is about how leaders need to care more or pay more attention to their people in order to enable them to do their jobs better. But like, who's taking care of the leaders?
Sure,
because it starts with them. So if the leaders are overworked, overwhelmed, not able to make clear decisions because they're, you know, stressed out, they're being put under too much pressure, you know, they've got unhappy clients or whatever the challenges are that they're facing, or there's a lot of change going on in the organization that they've got to take care of. Well, where is the mental capacity to then look after the other people when I, as a leader, I'm not even looking after myself in the first place? Not only that, I don't even know how to take care of myself. So I think we're facing this unprecedented time, not just in the world of work, in the world, where there's an incredible amount of distraction, both digitally and just generally. We've got a lot of stuff on our plates. There's a lot of things that are leading us to feel sort of overwhelmed and unable to focus. And so I think that, you know, that's where organizations should start. How do I, as a leader, work in a way that's healthy for me and can therefore support the people around me? And rather than constantly taking care of the needs of the business, we need to take care of the needs of us as humans, and then we will do really good work in our businesses. It just makes total sense, but we've totally lost the plot. And we're not paying attention to what matters most.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's quite a culture shift, really, to sort of change that way of thinking, I guess, within an organisation from the people, like away from the clients to the people. So going on to the common problems that you see with leaders and their plight for sort of conscious leadership, are there any friction points that you find more often than not? Is maybe the culture trying to shift it from the clients to the people one of the biggest challenges?
You have to focus on the clients.
Yeah.
You have to make money. It's naive to think that you can just focus on making everybody feel great at work.
Sure.
And not focus on the commercials. You have to do both. So it's about sort of purpose and profit. It's about people and profit. You know, those things can work together. I think the, you know, it's just gone too far in the wrong direction.
Yeah. It's,
you know, we're in a sort of pretty capitalist society where the commercials drive a lot of decision making and a lot of, you know, take up a lot of people's time. And also efficiency, so not just making money, but how do you save money? So you have to do that. That's really important. But you can't do it at any cost. So that's the first thing. You can't neglect the needs of your people in service of the shareholders. You know, everybody matters in this equation.
Yeah.
The shareholders, the leaders, and the people who are doing the actual work. So yeah, I think that there's a reality there where you just, you know, you have to know that you're paying attention to all of that. But I think that very often sort of organizational needs gazump the needs of the people.
Sure.
And forget that the people are the ones that are actually having to do the work and they're sort of fronting all of this up. So I think, I mean, if, in terms of what leaders need in this modern era, how they can make sure that they stay, focused and paying attention to the things that really matter. I think they need to understand what the business needs. I mean, that's the primary aim. They need to know what the purpose is of the organisation. They need to know why people are doing the work that they're doing. They need to know the roles that people play in that, and they need to be clear about everybody having a valuable role to play. But beyond that, they need to be connected to their people. So, I mean, what I saw during the recession, which was really interesting, was a bit of a shift in leaders actually being quite focused on people, to becoming more and more focused on the outside world, because they sort of felt they had to be. There was a greater level of noise there, and the people just got on and did the work. But, you know, over the course of years, that then takes its toll, because people aren't getting what they need from their leaders. You can't have a high-performing or even well-performing environment where the leaders are disconnected from the people around them. It simply doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's those relationships that actually fuel the performance in the first place. So, I mean, I've done quite a lot of work recently around continuous performance development and moving away from annual appraisals towards more regular check-ins. You know, ideally ditching annual appraisals totally because they just don't work.
Yeah.
And having regular conversations with your people, not about what they need to deliver on a day-to-day basis. You know, you should be having those conversations anyway, but how people are doing, the progress they're making towards their goals, whether their development is being supported, whether they have everything they need, how well they're feeling. You need to have those regular conversations to make sure that you're in touch with people and so that the people are focused on what they need to do. So communicating and connecting with your people is absolutely crucial. Secondly, something we've forgotten to do, or maybe we never really were very good at it, was our ability to listen.
Yeah.
To simply listen. I think very often you see leaders realizing too late that the writing was on the wall, or the information was all there if they'd just paid attention to it. Mm-hmm. We have these three monkeys at home on our windowsill. You know, see no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil.
Yeah.
And I think often, you know, this is where it links back to consciousness. I think we can be in this bubble where we think we're hearing the right stuff, or we think we're listening to people, but we're actually not listening to people at all.
Yeah.
And we're so good at sort of trying to make people feel better by saying, oh, you know, don't worry, it'll be okay, don't worry, don't worry. But you can't always do that. Without, you know, big, huge problems blowing up in the future.
Yeah.
You can't keep on sweeping it under the carpet and expect it to stay there. You know, at some point there will be no room under the carpet. It comes out. So, you know, listening is such a crucial skill, but one that actually many leaders have to learn, but not just leaders. You know, so I'm working with teams at the moment where listening skills are such a fundamental part of relationship building that you have to learn them. And just staying quiet for a few minutes can be absolutely the most uncomfortable thing that somebody's ever had to do, which is fascinating to see. But, you know, I've been on this journey myself. I wasn't good enough at listening, and, you know, as well as driving myself into the ground, I was doing the same to my team. I didn't really know how to respond to their needs. So, you know, that is a sort of crucial skill, as well as the sort of the other. So in terms of being a coach as a leader, which I also think is a vital trait of a good modern day leader, you have to be able to ask good questions too. So simply being curious, staying open-minded, asking good quality questions, and then being able to listen with interest and curiosity to what's coming back at you, two vitally important traits. But I think also taking time out, so you as a leader need to recognise the fact that you have to have time to reflect, you have to have thinking time, you have to have time to sort of assimilate everything that's going on around you. But I think many of us are just literally, you know, working 100% full throttle all the time, and we're just not taking any time out. And when we are taking time out, we're maybe drinking to make the pain go away. That sounds very dramatic, but you know, just to sort of chill out a bit, or you know, or we're having to look after our kids, or we're having to do all of the other stuff that we have to do when we get home after work. But we're very rarely taking time for reflection, which I think is where the real insight comes, and it's where people are the most creative. You know, it's why people have their best ideas in the shower. But we need more than the 5 minutes in the shower in the morning to sort of unravel everything that's going on in our minds. And I think the other thing, you know, there's two other things that I think are vital. One is giving clear direction to your people. They have to know why they're doing what they're doing. You have to agree with them what matters most and what the priorities are. And they have to know that there's a handful of things that have to be delivered, and therefore everything else, all of the other noise, is not something that they have to focus on, because we've only got a certain bandwidth. So how do you as a leader help your people focus on the things that absolutely matter most, so that all of the other distractions can just be pushed away for a time? And then, of course, because you're connecting with them constantly, you can continue to revisit that, so you can continue to reprioritize. And then healthy habits. I think that's the other thing that leaders need to learn more about, is one, how their own daily habits are impacting the people around them in terms of the way they work. So I was a bit of a nightmare. So I worked all the hours God sent, yet would constantly tell my people to stop working. So I'd be working long hours. I'd work all day, put the kids to bed, and then I'd get back on my laptop and be sending emails. Yet if I saw people working long hours, and my team unfortunately did work quite long hours, I'd be saying, you need to go home. And they'd be looking at me saying, but there's too much work. And I'm sure I would have generated a lot of that. And then at one point, the team turned around and said, can you like stop sending us emails in the evenings? Because we feel we have to answer them. And I said, oh, don't. Like, you don't have to answer them. And they were like, well, we see them pop up, and then they cause us stress. So then we had to put this rule in place that there was a certain time in the day that we couldn't send emails after. But I was totally oblivious to the impact that I was having on the people around me. Just didn't know. Really didn't understand it.
And that's quite an interesting point, actually. So often it is not the leaders who are aware of the problem of an unhappy workplace, but the staff beneath them, like you mentioned with your emails. So how do you advise that employees broach this topic? So obviously they just spoke to you, but perhaps they might not feel they have the authority to action anything or speak to the people above them who might be causing these problems.
Yeah, okay. So I think there's two sides to this story. I think that you can be working in a culture that doesn't enable you for whatever reason. Either, you know, there's too much work, or the processes don't work, or there's not enough resource, or your leader isn't doing the job that, you know, you would like them to do. That is one side of the story. But the other side of the story is that we as people aren't actually taking care of our own well-being needs either. So I call this in the book sort of this split between internal and external conditions. So, you know, we often look outside of ourselves and pay attention to all the things that aren't working for us in our external environment, either that be in work or outside of work. Yet we don't pay enough attention to how we're being and how we're taking care of our own mental health and the extent to which our mindset and our beliefs are either limiting us or helping us to grow and thrive. And so I think there's two answers to this question, really, or two sides to the answer. One is you have to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
So I hear a lot of people when I'm coaching them talking about the fact that I have to do this and I have to do that. I have to switch on my computer at night. I have to stay in the office until, you know, a certain time. I have to respond to this person when they email me. I have to tell the client that I will deliver this certain project by a certain date, even though I know it's totally not realistic and I'm going to break my people. So my first challenge to people would be, do you actually have to?
Yeah.
Who's telling you to do that? So I can remember speaking to a fellow board member a few years ago who actually, I think, you know, at the time was probably trying to help me, but I just didn't hear it.
Sure.
And I was at this board meeting and I think I was missing something that my kids were doing. And I was saying to him, like, I just have to be here. And he was like, well, you sort of don't. I mean, you could have just said that you needed to leave early today. And I was like, oh, I just don't think I could. I think I sort of just need to be here all the time. And I would feel really uncomfortable doing that. And he was like, well, you shouldn't.
Sure.
And you should just speak up. And I didn't. Now, on reflection, I actually totally believe that I could have.
Yeah.
I could have said, my kids have got this thing on and I need to leave at 3. So I think very often we put barriers in the way of our own well-being.
Sure.
Because we presume that the people around us have these expectations that maybe they don't have. Now, sometimes they do have them.
Yeah, sure.
Unfortunately, sometimes people expect us to compromise our own personal lives for the sake of the business. And the reality of the situation is sometimes we just have to. That is work life, unfortunately.
Mm.
What I would say is, if your working environment is pushing you to constantly compromise your own life, your home life, the time you have with your children, your own well-being, the relationships that you have, I would be seriously questioning whether you're working in the right environment.
Yeah.
Because you do have an option to get out. Mm. So don't hang in regardless. There are other organisations who are doing this better that you can go and work for. Go and find them. But on the other hand, I think, you know, if you are paying attention to your own well-being, if you are taking care of your own mental health, and I mean, you are taking regular rest breaks during the day, once again, if your environment allows for that to happen,
yeah.
You are taking time to reflect, you are doing exercise, you are eating well, you aren't drinking too much, or putting other things into your body that unfortunately impact your mental health. You're even meditating because you've learned how to do that, or you're doing yoga. So all of these things are things that remove stuff from your stress bucket.
Yeah.
Our stress buckets are going to fill up. That's sort of inevitable. But there's things that sometimes, you know, that dissolve to some extent. The impact that the difficult stuff has on us. If you're not taking care of your own physiology, if you're not getting enough sleep, and I mean, this isn't about just having sleep, it's having good sleep, and it's having at least 7 hours a day. If you haven't figured that out, well, you need to focus there.
Sure.
Because, you know, the quality of your waking hours is directly related to the quality of your sleeping hours. You need to figure out how to get better sleep. And there's a huge, you know, there's a number of experts out there, and there's a huge number of books, actually, on that topic. One is called Why We Sleep, which I would heavily recommend to people. So, you know, you need to get rest, you need to eat well, you need to be drinking water, you need to be sleeping well, you need to be paying attention to your own physiology to make sure you're balanced. And if you're not, if you've got a bad back, go and see somebody about it.
Mm.
If you're getting regular headaches, go and see somebody about it. If you're feeling sick, go and see somebody about it. If you're feeling too anxious, go and see somebody about it. Go and get these problems sorted. It's so easy for us to look at the world around us and think that we are feeling that way as a consequence of everything and everybody else. That you have, you know, you have so much more control over your well-being than you recognise. And then on the other side, you know, you're saying about how do you influence the people around you to do things differently. Small changes. I mean, in the book, there's a case study that I did with the insolvency service where they created an A to Z of well-being. And that came out of a leadership development program where there were a group of people who had to work on sort of a live business challenge.
Sure.
And in terms of the purpose of the insolvency service, they've made it quite clear that they wanted to take care of people's well-being. So that was quite empowering in the first instance, because it meant that employees could actually respond to that, and they knew that the leaders were already bought into it. So Leaders do need to think about the messaging that they're giving out about the culture and the environment that they're trying to create. If they're very explicit about the fact that they do want to take care of people's well-being, then people will know that they can take action around that.
Yeah.
So they created this A to Z, which was basically, 26 ideas of how you can take better care of your own well-being and how you can work as a team in order to take care of each other's well-being. And it really flew. People seem to have really engaged with it, and they're able then to take more personal responsibility for doing things within their own teams. So, it doesn't have to be a company-wide strategy to fix this problem. You can come up with ideas within your own teams. I mean, within one of the teams I work with, we run Wellness Wednesday. So once a month, we get together as a team, and then for the people that can't make that session, we do a mop-up session for everybody else, where we talk about the things that actually allow us to take better care of ourselves. So we talk about what leads to emotional well-being. We talk about what creates psychological safety in the working environment and what we need to do as a team to improve that. We talk about things like financial well-being, which is another really significant thing that impacts people's well-being at work on a day-to-day basis. And we actually just open up the conversation. So in doing that, you create this culture where people feel that they are psychologically safe, and they can speak up and they can say, I don't feel particularly great at the moment.
Yeah.
What do I need to do to help myself, and what maybe could other people do around me to help me too? So some of it is just about sort of opening up the conversation and recognising that every single person in the organisation can make a slight difference, either to themselves or to the people around them. It's not always at the, at the feet of the leaders to make the changes. That they have a role to play too, but everybody is involved in them.
So Natasha, what led you to write The Conscious Effect?
So, I've always been hugely driven to help people to learn more about how to make their lives better, or to, get further on in their careers, or to perform better. And so, I had years of experience of working within organisational development, so leadership development and behavioural change and sort of vision and values projects, where you're trying to set a sort of new narrative for the organisation.
Yeah.
That people can, that sort of shapes and helps to drive the right performance. When I finished in my role, I knew that I had something to say, and that it was maybe different to what a lot of people were already hearing.
Yeah.
And because I'd had this massive wake-up call, I was a bit like, hold on one second. So I've been working in HR for my whole career. I saw myself as the people specialist, the one that understood how to get the best out of people, that would notice when people's mental health wasn't great and would try to, intervene, was constantly trying to help everybody else. And I suddenly, realised, it dawned on me that I hadn't helped myself for my whole career. And actually, probably in the last few years in my role, I was technically and professionally growing, but I wasn't personally growing. I just plateaued. I wasn't really paying any attention to myself at all. So I thought, other people have to know this. Other people have to know that there is another way, that you have to pay as much attention to your technical professional growth as you do your own personal growth, because otherwise you do just stagnate and potentially even start going backwards.
Yeah.
And also, if you aren't connected to yourself, then you're potentially not connected to other people. But if you're a leader having to lead other people, then how the hell do you motivate them when you don't really get people? So I thought, right, I have to help leaders understand what's really going on. And this book was sort of like a wake-up call. I mean, it was fortunate that you guys contacted me really early on in that journey. So I left my job in the October, and I had a call from Lid in the April.
Right.
You had seen what I'd been posting on LinkedIn about the link between leadership and well-being, and had said that you hadn't published any other books in that space, and would I be interested in writing a book? And I jumped at the chance. And what was really interesting is one of the first things you asked me to do was write the contents pages.
Yeah.
We already had the title for the book, which was 50 Lessons for Better Organisational Wellbeing. And I must admit, I probably wrote that contents in about 2 hours. It was just there.
Yeah.
I didn't have to go and research what should be in the book. It was just all there. And I'd already started to build the conscious leadership model that's in the book, which was the sort of new age model of leadership. And then all I really had to do was, using my experience of what I saw worked really well and what didn't work well, and then all the research that I subsequently did, the book just sort of came together. And I mean, it's been amazing because it's been so well received. I think as an author, you write a book and think, right, you know, is it just my 10 family members who are going to be buying that?
Sure,
yeah. And it was a nice experience, a nice project. And, you know, now I'll get on and do my day job.
Yeah.
But actually, I've been overwhelmed by the feedback. People think that this is actually really helping them. And I wrote it in a way. So when I was an HR director, I used to chastise myself a lot for not reading as much as I should. But it was just because by the end of the day, after I'd done all the work, I had no energy to read.
Yeah.
So I actually wrote the book that I would have read back then. So in these 50 lessons. So, you know, you learn a little bit about a topic in 3 to 4 pages, and then you can put the book down again and you don't have to look at it for another couple of weeks or another few months. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's whatever, you know, whatever you want. People are reading it from page to page, you know, from start to finish, which is amazing. But I wrote it in a way that was really accessible because I thought, you know, it wasn't reasonable to think in a world where people are already under a huge amount of pressure that me turning up with some tome that they had to read from end to end to sort their problems out was reasonable, because it obviously wasn't realistic. So, yeah, so I feel that it's filled a gap in the market that hadn't previously been filled, and I'm just really, really pleased about that.
So thank you so much, Natasha, for joining us today and for giving us an insight into your book, The Conscious Effect. If you do want to find out more, and I encourage you to do so, go to our website, www.lidpublishing.com, or keep an eye on our social media at Lid Publishing. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I'll see you next time on Lid Radio Podcast.